This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Becca Milstein, co-founder and CEO of Fishwife, a tinned seafood company bringing ethically sourced, premium, and delicious tinned seafood to pantries across the U.S. Fishwife launched in December of 2020 and has been featured in the New York Times, Bon Appetit, Food & Wine, Vogue, and like 30 to 80 other publications. You can find it at eatfishwife.com or in many specialty shops across the country. Welcome, Becca.
Thank you so much, Allie. As a frequent listener, it's an honor.
I love, okay, so before we even get into anything, you know, you are a frequent listener of In the Sauce.
It's true.
Has there ever been a question that I've asked or like a topic that I've brought up that you're like, ooh, I want to chime in here. There's something I want to say.
I think there have actually been times when I wanted people to dig more into fundraising and capital and bootstrapping and just how people go about funding their businesses. I feel like
It's a little cagey,
but I feel like it's so, so confusing to first-time founders, speaking from personal experience.
Yeah.
So it's actually the opposite of what you asked me. It's something that you did not ask.
Right.
But I'm always curious to know how people fund their businesses because it's such an important part of the whole thing, obviously.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, just jumping right in, you know, you bring up a really good point. Last week, I don't know if you heard Mark Samuel, he was on the show and he said something along the lines of, you know, not everyone had a dad who's a banker and went to Yale. Yeah. And, you know, I was kind of like, hey, just raising my hand, like I had a dad who was a banker and I went to Duke. Like, I don't ever want to mislead anyone into thinking that where we're at is just a function of like grit and hard work, because it is very much a function of that. And also graduating from college without debt and having access to capital or friends and family with capital. And especially I think, you know, there's always a question of, you know, when you are raising, you don't really want people to know because you don't want to be quote unquote like out there, you know, and you don't want your numbers all over the place. And there is something sort of like private to all of it. And, you know, there's a little bit of a, we're doing so well, we don't need money kind of bullshit thing that doesn't actually mean anything. And I think our relationship with money in general, and especially as women, is a little bit, you know, flawed. So to your point, the more honest that we can be, the better. But even me, you know, I'm pretty open on these things. I definitely, that is an area that I do keep a little bit more like closely breasted, I guess.
I mean, I think that totally makes sense. And you know, I think I lean towards transparency in a way that could totally be a product of, you know, first time founder naivete, but I do think there's a way to talk about it in sort of broad strokes that just does illuminate, you know, some of the things that are that were so confusing to me and are still confusing to me. But, you know, through countless conversations with advisors and peers, I do feel I've gained some clarity about some like fundamental questions about, you know, what is art? What is science? I think that's the line you hear from everyone mm-hmm. when you're fundraising is it's a mixture of art and science. And that's true. And just understanding like the parts where you really should lean into the art and parts where you really should lean into the science, I think is can be key.
I think also, you know, very early on, I was with another founder and I was raising like our seed round and we ran into someone who was kind of a potential investor, but not really. And he said, like, how's it going? And I was like, well, you know, it's been really interesting. Like, it's really interesting, the questions that people ask. And I feel like I'm learning a lot. And she, like, kicked me under the table. And she was like, he wants to hear, it's going amazing. It's, like, crazy how quickly the money's rolling in. And I was like, but I'm not good at that. And she was like, but that's not for everyone, but for some people, that's how you have to roll.
Yeah.
You know, she was just, it was very helpful because I think to art and science, there's also like, who are you being transparent and authentic with? And that isn't everybody. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it can't be because there is still, you know, despite all of these, you know, I think we talked about it a little bit, like everything on Netflix, Hulu, and HBO right now is like a cautionary tale about a founder who lies their way to jail, you know, or in Adam Newman's case, like lies their way to like billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And no one seems to lose except for the people that worked for him. But, you know, you would think that maybe there would be a little bit of a reckoning with that sort of, you know, create the FOMO, LF, go, you know, go kind of hashtag rocket ship nonsense. But yet, you know?
I think that's that is exactly the point that I'm making is, I mean, I think it's true. We have built these cultures where raising a ton of money at a super high valuation from specific people and funds is super, super celebrated. And I think on the flip side, you know, bootstrapping is amazing, but bootstrapping a business like ours is very, very challenging, if not impossible. So it's like, we also have to look at the realities of, yes, acknowledging our privilege, those of us that were, you know, just got a huge head start in that regard. So yeah, I think it's important to be transparent where you can and just say, you know, raise the money that you need at a valuation that you can achieve and raise it from great people. And those, I guess, are like sort of the broad strokes things that I would say is like.
So on a totally sort of different note, although, you know, definitely like cool, buzzworthy, et cetera, rather than starting with sort of the beginning of Fishwife, which, by the way, I think, you know, I happen to be a huge tinned fish person to the point where like several of my gifts for my birthday last week were either sardine related or like I got a pair of socks that said tinned fish. Like I am your target demographic. I love to hear it. Yes. But you know, aside from sort of like, we will get to like the brand and just it's beautiful and the idea and everything, but I do want to talk about sort of this most recent thing almost first, because you guys just launched a collab with Fly by Jing.
Yes, we did. Well, it actually does. Even this question takes us back to the origins of Fishwife, because I reached out to Jing over LinkedIn, I think in November 2020, and just was a huge fan of her company and thought what she was doing was amazing, knew she was in LA. So we started talking then and then kind of just became really close. I'm not even sure what happened, but at some point we just became super close. And you know, I mean, Jing's business is probably...
Yeah,
it's amazing. And it's probably like three years ahead of where Fishwife is right now. So having a very close ally like that is, you know, you cannot measure the value of it. So anyway, we've been friends for a while and we have eaten. The first time we got together, we put the chili crisp on. It was actually our smoked tuna. And it was amazing. Like something about the like Szechuan Nemen quality, the spiciness with like the smoky sweetness of our products was really, really a unique flavor combination. So we had just kind of been waiting for the right time to do it. And I would say, you know, I spent the first year in the business working really hard to scale up our production capacity because you know, for a lot of the first year of the business, we were very hand to mouth on inventory. It was like it would come down from the cannery and we'd ship it out and then need to do the same. So, you know, finally in early this year, we got to a place where we were flush with inventory, which was a dream, and had additional production capacity to start doing these limited collaborations. And obviously Jing was the first person that I wanted to do it with. So it was very simple. I will give away this trade secret. It truly was taking our two best-selling products and smashing them together. Not an extensive product development process. But it was
not easy. I mean, maybe it's easier. I don't know. I mean, everything's easier when it's not fresh. So yeah. I'm going to give that but you know, I do think first of all, I love the story because it's not just a brand collaboration, but it's like actually like a true collaboration and a connection between the two of you. I also read on LinkedIn that you guys share an office. Is that right?
Yes, it is the dream that I am currently living in, which is a close friend of mine is the chairman CEO of Acid League, which might sound out of blue, but he came to me looking to potentially open up a space in LA and, you know, proposed we do it together and then bring another brand into the fold. And again, Jing was the first person I thought of because she, their team had an office pre-COVID and then I think they'd closed it down. So they didn't have a space they were working out of and were simultaneously building up their LA team. So anyway, and Jing just gets shit done. So the minute that I told her about this, we had a realtor meeting or tour of 10 offices the next week. And it just went very quickly. And everything that I thought it would be, it has been.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, being in such close proximity to a company I admire hugely, a CEO I admire, and a team that just is absolutely top notch. And seeing how they work together and communicate. I was able to see that from the vantage point of creating a product together and launching it, and also from just sharing an office with all of these brilliant people. So
yeah.
I full accelerator program for me.
No, it's amazing. I mean, we have a space. It's kind of the same vibe. I mean, it's not as, we don't technically share it with anyone, but we definitely have other brands and other founders and other teams work out of here. They make content here. You know, I think for those of us who, it can be a lonely job, right? Yeah. And it can be, frustrating. There's a lot of stuff that's just no one seems to be picking up. Trucks don't seem to be getting anywhere. Then you feel kind of bad because you're but the world, all I'm doing is really making sauce. You know, you go through this whole mental loop pretty much on the day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to have other teams, especially... I would imagine, especially someone who is that year or two ahead, it's kind of it's much better than having someone 10 or 15 years ahead, right? Yeah. Because we were talking about before the recording, sometimes people forget, they're I remember when we blah, 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 but you're but do you? Do you remember the pain?
And also the ecosystem has changed. I mean, it changes on a month-to-month basis. I mean, if we're talking about D2C especially, but, the D2C landscape, the fundraising landscape, the retail landscape, these things change, every 6 months into some significant way. So
yeah, that's really true. Well, I love it. And I guess the question going back to sort of you said it was very easy. You kind of did a smash up of your two best-selling products, but, it's got to start somewhere. Did you bring... Were you just hello fisheries, or canning companies, here's this and pack it in this instead of that. And there you go. Or, was it more complicated than that? I would imagine.
Totally. Well, I will say, and I know you talk about co-packers a lot on this, and the complexities and nuances of working with co-packers, and there are unlimited amounts, but I'm working with a cannery right now in Washington State, and they have just been totally aligned with like what mm-hmm. they, you know, they see our vision and they have their own vision. And they've just been incredibly amenable to doing like innovative new things with us and yeah. doing small batches. And, you know, I think we were one of their first sort of bigger co-packing clients. So mm-hmm. they were kind of working out, you know, and I would say are still working out exactly how they want to be as a co-packer.
Right.
But I think maybe where like with more established co-packers, and I can't speak from my own experience, but from hearing others, you know, they're these huge co-packers that are, you know, pumping out inventory and do not have time to be experimenting with it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like we got super, super lucky in that regard. And I'm like,
yeah,
so grateful for that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've been hearing a lot of people just saying either they've gotten kicked off their lines mm-hmm. because the co-packer is down to a very like skeleton crew and yeah. they just can't take the little company anymore. Even if you're like doing 3 to 5 million in sales, which feels like a lot for you, it's just not a lot for them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, friends of mine who've just had their prices raised like for the third time in, you know, 6 months and are having a hard time figuring out how to have a gross margin that's like okay at all, you know? I mean, in your opinion, is there something, was it just luck or was there something that you feel you were looking for? Or what questions do you think are the right questions to ask? You know, alignment is sort of the key to all of this.
Yeah.
But how were you able to sort of figure out whether you were aligned?
Yeah, great question. And I will say we did get kicked out of our first co-packer. We were working with a different cannery in the Pacific Northwest and they just, you know, their labor was cut in half. It mm-hmm. was the height of fishing season up there and they just were totally, totally inundated. And unfortunately, it was just a rather abrupt, like, we're not going to have product for you for the next 3 months. And it was
right.
the worst day I've had since starting the business.
Yeah.
And we were super fortunate because I had started working on the smoked salmon product with this other cannery in Washington. So I had started building that relationship. And then, you know, I came to them and was like, guys, can we right. do two more SKUs with you?
Yeah.
And thankfully, and this is like so luck, they were also, you know, they were very much looking to build out this part of their business.
Right.
So it was like, I mean, the stars aligning in an insane way. So yeah, I think I was so grateful to be able to work with them and be able to expand our relationship over an extremely short period of time, in parentheses, right before the holidays, nightmare of my life. and they were looking to bulk up their business. So I think they were, you know, just down to put the pedal to the metal and figure it out.
Right. I do I think one of the things that we've learned, you know, there was a daily on the, you know, how Ukraine is affecting food prices, you know, which of course is like, you know, insignificant compared to obviously like the human cost. But in our business, we do have to be aware of the cost of sunflower oil and the cost of fuel and the cost of, you know, everything basically, right? And I do think the advice that I would give is even if you have a great relationship, even if you have a great co-packer, build a backup. The key mm-hmm. to this game is really contingencies upon contingencies. Yep. For every ingredient, have three lined up just in mm-hmm. case that one, you know, we had a tahini come in. And it was roasted for like a minute longer than our normal tahini. And it was just too dark. It was just a darker brown. And so our golden tahini looked like mustard brown tahini, you know. And then so it just meant that, you know, we needed to do like color cards and stuff that, you know, everything that happens is like a learning experience. But if I can spare people the pain of the learning experience, it would be, even if you're comfortable right now and you're happy, find a backup for every ingredient, for every package, for every producer and agency and everything. Like, have backups.
Have backups and have contracts. I think that's, you know, of the many things that I think people don't tell you to do because it seems so obvious to them.
Yep.
Is having contracts with your co-mans and suppliers if they're willing.
Yeah, it is always surprising when they're willing to like do things without one. I'm like, shouldn't there, isn't this like a little, like, yeah, it feels like something should be signed somewhere. But yes, I think that's a really good point. And unfortunately, sometimes you're going to have to go back to that contract and say like, hey, reminder, you know, this is here. And they're going to say like, yeah, you know, why are you bringing up the contract? You have to be like, because you are not in accordance with it, you know? But, you know, those relationships are important, clearly. Anything else before we take the break on like just building out the supply chain, like before?
Oh my gosh, you know, there's so much. Yeah, I mean, I think, what would I say? Yes, get contracts where you can. Understand that those contracts will not be cheap to create with your counsel. So, you know, put aside $5,000-$6,000 for that.
Was there anything surprising about all, like, were you, I mean, going back to sort of like getting ready to launch this thing, was the front end part is like, I always think of, you know, the graphics and the name and the vibe of the brand and everything. Was there stuff that surprised you about the back end?
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm just like, where to begin? I mean, yeah, I think, I would say I was surprised at the willingness of people to hop on board and have been so. I think one thing, I know. One thing that was interesting about this business in particular was that, you know, when I was talking to canneries in the U.S. mostly at the beginning, I was told constantly that it was a declining industry and, you know, do I want to look at a pouch instead? And obviously I was not interested in looking at that at the time. But I think, you know, when you do see an opportunity like that, which obviously I saw an opportunity for tinned seafood to, you know, gain a huge foothold in the U.S. In the way that it has in most other countries in the world. And being able to, you know, convince your co-packers of that and really make them understand what a massive business opportunity, you know, you are sharing with them. I think actually the biggest thing, and this is on the same note, but the biggest thing that has surprised me about, I mean, I would say supply chain particularly, but obviously all facets of running a business is like, it is truly all about relationships and the human touch. And like, that makes sense for, you know, more of the social media and the marketing and, you know, like maybe even retail relationships feel more human driven, but the impact that your personal relationship with your suppliers and co-packers can have, can yield, you know, incredibly tangible business benefits. Yeah. So, I mean, like my number one, like advice, to people starting businesses is just like form those personal relationships as the founder or the co-founder or what have you, with like every single element of, you know, every single piece that the business touches, whether it's press or co-packers, but, you know, with suppliers, you know, we've been able to at times get rates that are super, super competitive because of, you know, I would say the relationship and in turn, like the promise of what the business can do. So,
yeah. And I think to that point, you know, one thing is certainly the relationships. There is just something about having an actual human connection. And the other thing is like, these are also people that you are selling. You know, I think there's a misunderstanding. I kind of say this a lot, but I think the founder in capital F has a misunderstanding that they have invented something incredible that the world is just going to want and that everyone's going to want to be a part of and that you'd be lucky to get to co-pack. And it is a very humbling experience when you realize, like, even if you have a cult following, it still doesn't mean anything to some of those people, right? And so I would say that the relationship is key, but also, like, these are also your customers, even if you are paying them, right? Like, everyone that is touching this business is looking to the person with the vision, which is ultimately you, to keep them excited about what you're building. And I think that's why it is tiring. And that's why, you know, we need to build in some real downtime, because, you know, you're constantly, like, energizing and constantly regrouping and constantly bringing someone back into the excitement, you know, and it's like a whack-a-mole game a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, one last thing I'll just say on that is, and it kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation, knowing who you are kind of quote unquote selling to, and knowing the people that you have to be kind of selling to always, and the people that you really have to be transparent with always. I think that's a very key and nuanced dynamic that we all have to navigate. But, like, you know, your lawyer, you do not have to sell. I mean, this is just me speaking, but you do not have to sell your lawyer. You're paying them.
No, you should be totally honest with your lawyer all the time.
Yes, exactly. But yes, I think even you can get, you again, it's what you said, Ali. It's like, you can totally think, I'm paying this co-packer for a service and that's that. But from the beginning and for the many years you're engaged with them, you want them to stay on board and to fight for you to get line time and to fight for you to get, you know, in my case, salmon.
I mean, exactly. You want your salmon.
I want salmon.
We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and back up and, like, talk about the beginning of the company and all that. So we'll be right back.
Did you know that over 70% of diners research a restaurant online before ordering from or going in person? Your digital front door is more important than ever. Let BentoBox design and build you a beautifully branded website. BentoBox websites provide sleek design and seamless content management, creating impactful first impressions and converting visitors into customers. And with built-in commerce and marketing tools like online ordering, gift cards, automated email, and more, you can also grow your revenue and keep your diners coming back. Join over 8,000 restaurants that leverage BentoBox to power their digital presence and deliver great hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef. This episode is supported by HRN business member Food Karma Projects, dedicated to community building by creating unique food events that showcase the best local food, chefs, beer, and wine. Get fired up for the return of Brisket King NYC to taste the very best brisket, pastrami, brisket tacos, sliders, and more. It all takes place on Wednesday, April 20th from 6 to 9 p.m. outside at Pig Beach in Gowanus, Brooklyn. To purchase tickets or for more information about this Meat Lovers Fest, visit brisketking.com. Food Karma Projects supports HRN's creative educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
I'm back with Becca Milstein from Fishwife. Okay, so backing up a bit, we kind of started now and we're going back to the beginning. So you just were a tin fish lover and thought to yourself, how come this isn't, like, how come you look at other countries and there are all these beautiful packages and here we don't? And that was that?
Not exactly, no.
What happened? Tell me what happened.
It's a really funny story. I mean, aren't they all? But I was living with a very close friend, Caroline, during COVID. And this is, like, peak, you know, beginning COVID. So we moved in together in March 2020. And, you know, during COVID, you're locked up, you don't have a lot to do. You don't have a lot to talk about.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, strange objects take on a life of their own. So we had been eating a lot of tinned fish, you know, like just obviously during COVID, when you are not walking down to the Sweet Green on the corner,
right.
and you have to be buying, you know, ostensibly shelf stable food is the way to go because you don't know if the grocery store will be crazy. You're trying to limit those trips, et cetera. So
right.
we were buying and eating a lot of tinned fish. And as a consumer, I was totally the average American, loved tuna fish sandwiches. But beyond that, you know, I would say I had traveled to Spain. I had lived in Spain during college and was exposed to conservas and how like magical and beautiful that the culture was there. But other than that, it had not been a huge part of my life. But
I was raised on sardines. I just want to throw this out there. I was told that sardines were like magic and that they have RNA, which I don't even know what that means. But I still remember my mother saying that to me. And just as a completely random side note, I went on this Outward Bound trip and it was like 38 days on a 13-foot sailboat with like 12 other kids.
Wow.
And I was the only one on the boat that ate sardines because they all didn't. And I came back and I was like glowing. I was so freaking radiantly healthy. And it was, I don't know if it's because they made us jump in like the water every day, which was, you know, our only means of like sanitizing ourselves. But I just want to share that. So I just feel like you should know that about me. You just got to know that like I'm bursting here with love. And like I shared it a little at the beginning, but I really do love fish that is canned. It's like I eat it right out of the can. I don't need it mixed with anything. I don't need it on a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm picturing myself in COVID because I think I also ate it every single day. And I tried to not have tuna every single day because, you know, that made me nervous. So I had a lot of sardines. Okay.
No, phew. I mean.
Okay, I'm done now. You can go back to telling the origin story of your company. I just need to let you know.
I love to know that I'm talking to my target audience. It makes me feel very, very, very good. Confident.
You're locked and loaded. We are aligned now. So you're in COVID. You're eating tinned fish.
We're eating tinned fish all the time. We're also cooking. I just have to point this out. We were eating this trout from Costco and we were like weirdly obsessed with this beautiful, it was just these beautiful full fillets of trout. And we really were just eating them once a week and just talking about them and, you know, inordinate amount.
Right.
You can imagine peak COVID. Yep. So, I mean, I say that mostly because that trout ended up being the trout that we have in our cans today, which is very, very cool.
That is very cool.
But going back to the origin story, me and Caroline were literally on a hike. We were doing a lot of hiking, bouncing back and forth business ideas, and literally just came to tinned fish.
What were you doing before this?
I worked in the music industry for about 4.5 years. I know it sounds, it sounds very unrelated, but ultimately, like along with making very tasty products and building some really wonderful supply chains, obviously the brand for this company has been
huge,
very powerful. And that's what I did in my past life.
Yeah. No, the brand is crazy good. I mean, the graphics are amazing. The vibe is amazing. The name is amazing. I mean, you crushed that.
Thank you so much. It was definitely the funnest part for me personally. I mean, we came up with this idea and we're just calling our friends on the ride home from this hike, asking them if they thought, you know, we called all of our like hip foodie friends.
Right.
Our, like trendy gals. And we were just getting like a unanimous thumbs up. And we just went home and drank a lot of wine and ate a lot of sardines. I mean, there's a picture of us on that day.
Aww, I love that.
Yeah, it was just honestly such an obvious idea once we landed upon it. And
right.
I think the thing that drove that drove me to get it out to the world so quickly was just like the thought that, wow, this is so ridiculously obvious. There must be 100 people working yep. on tin fish companies right now. And it turned out there was only one, and that brand, Scout, has become, you know, some of my closest allies and friends.
That's, you know, that's the classic sort of Vita Coco, Zico, you know, they needed each other to build this category. Yep. You know, I mean, you're not doing that with, you know,
Bumblebee,
right? Yeah. So I think that that is also a very good takeaway. You know, someone said like collaborators or compatibles or something. There was like some word where like, you know, because there's like, for instance, there are just some categories where there just seems to be a lot, you know, like sparkling beverage right yeah. now. And, you know, and a lot of them are just like super friendly and, you know, sharing resources. There's a cap for every bottle. You know, there's, I think this winner take all mentality ridiculous. Is just, it's ridiculous. I mean, there are lots of consumers and there's lots of pockets of consumers. And going back to your point from earlier, you know, when we talk about sort of the money piece, you know, is there likely one that's going to get bought by someone sooner? Probably, you know, if you look at like the hydration, right? The liquid IV kind of was like the first one to get snapped up. And,
yep.
you know, there is some
validity.
There is some truth to some of it, but it's so early in yep. all of the life cycles of all these businesses. And it's hard enough that, you know, without having sort of weird vibes with another company. I kind of wish there was someone else doing what we were doing because it'd be fun, you know, to like just have someone that we could be next to on the shelf. But that is not our problem. It felt really obvious. That's the best, you know, when the puzzle piece just kind of fits in.
Yeah.
And then were you just immediately starting thinking about names and what it was going to look like and the vibe and all that? Was that yeah. just like your brain just went into, you know, creative mode?
Yep. Just, yeah, immediately obsessed with it. And like, I would say the first thing that we did, which I think is the common way to go, but for people that, you know, don't think about it this way, like I just spent a month, maybe two, just talking to every single entrepreneur I could get my hands on. And one of those entrepreneurs was, you know, my friend Greer, who runs this amazing textile company called Block Shop with her sisters. And this does have a meaning to the end of it. She was the one that found the word fishwife. You know, just like having those conversations. I mean, obviously that conversation was incredibly impactful, but you know, you start really wide just talking to, again, like a textile company, which has nothing on the out, you know, from the outside to do with tinned fish. But, you know, Greer is, again, one of my very closest friends to talk to, you know, I mean, she's a very close friend, but we also talk about marketing all the time and like strategize together.
I think that's another like really good point of advice. It does seem fairly obvious. Most times, you know, like I'm sure you've done something like this, but I'm like a guest lecturer at, you know, whatever, entrepreneurship classes and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I always start by saying like, what are your ideas so that we can actually like make use of the next hour and a half rather than me just like talking? And they're usually very reluctant. And I'm like, hey guys, you're like, no one's going to steal your idea. Like you got to stop like caging it, because what you need to do is talk a lot and ask a ton of questions. And if you are worried that like the person next to you in your class is going to like somehow take an idea out of your head and make it better than you, then you probably are onto the wrong idea.
Yeah.
Like, let's just talk, you know, and just ask and just open it up, because I think a lot of times people don't do what you did because they're nervous, but, you know, don't be nervous.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of my closest advisors, Adam Eskin from Dig, I had a copycat and I was upset about it. And I called him to talk about it. And he said something that is the truest, which is, it is all about execution. The idea itself is worth literally nothing. So,
I mean, exactly.
Whenever you have, and I know all of my founder peers, all of us have, you know, one or multiple copycats that feel really, totally, you know, kind of painful. But at the end of the day, it's just like, that should just only drive you to make your company so much more, the more interesting and stronger, because those people, it's all about execution, you know?
Yeah. I remember when, you know, I had a cooking school for 8 years and in like year six, someone literally almost took the exact name, took our logo, built a kitchen that looked exactly like ours, basically copied our class schedule. Ugh. They had come, they had taken like 15 to 20 classes at Haven's Kitchen. And then, and I was just, I felt like I was so angry and so upset. And I had a friend look at me and she said, there could be a Heaven's Kitchen literally next to you. Like on the same block, 6 feet away, and you would walk in there and maybe you would think, huh, this is weird. It's the same. Yeah. But after like 30 seconds in there, you would not feel the same energy. You wouldn't feel the same like commitment. You wouldn't feel any of the stuff that makes this place what it is. And it's, I've taken that. And then she was like, it was Tuesday. She was like, you have until Friday to like get over this. I was like, okay. So I was like, on Thursday, I was still like seething. And I was like, I have until Friday. Like I have until end of day Friday. And you know, she was like, fine. And then, you know, I processed it and it was okay. But I've taken that into the brand. Like, yeah, it's kind of the annoying, like, well, clearly you're onto something, but it's more than that. It's more than like the competition means that you're onto something. To your point, the idea, even if you start with the idea at the same time, a lot of people have the same idea at the same time, right? Yeah. That's why we have like 18 things about Uber right now and WeWork, right? They're all the same. But one is completely watchable and the other is sort of painful. Right. To your point, like it's about the ongoing living, breathing company that you're creating, that ongoing, you know, connection with the consumers, the consistent research that you're doing, you know, learning more about who they are and why they like you and what they want from you. And, you know, obviously in your case, there's like this, that intangible sort of like brand factor that people, if it's not there, it's very hard and you can't really pay for it, you know? So, okay. Going back to, you know, you started with direct to consumer. You do have retail, like you are in stores. Did you have a strategy? Were you thinking about, you know, what you wanted this to build out like, and you know, where did you, did you hire someone? Like what, where were your sort of intentions around, you know, building out a team and a plan?
Yeah. Great question. So obviously a million things change over the course of running a business. But I will say our distribution strategy has really not wavered at all. And I mean, you actually are a great example of a business that, you know, it's a totally different thing. And the place where you started was not, okay, let's get this D2C thing going and juice that for all we can and then move on.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that wasn't even an option for me.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes your product just determines it for you. You know, we're really fortunate to have a product that is, you know, not only has a 4 to 5 year shelf life, but also as like wartime food. So it can't be, I think we've had one smashed tin and I was like, did someone run this over? Right. It's, you know, made for, you know, the battlefield. So it's very, very durable. Yeah. But you know, the plan from the beginning was always start online. You know, obviously tried and true. It's such a fun way to build a community, to like be speaking directly to your customer all the time and learn so much from them, all that good stuff. And you get all the data from D2C, et cetera. So to me and for our product, it was quite obvious that was the way to go.
And mostly, I mean, when you say start online, like mostly just organic, or did you start with like an ad strategy from the beginning? Like, were you like, we need to build awareness, or were you like, we need to just like start and see who's buying it and see like, what was that plan a little bit?
Yeah, totally. So I would say as a person, as a human on this earth, I definitely, for better or for worse, lean qualitatively.
Right.
Is how instinctually I think, instinct has driven the entire growth of this business, yeah. Which is, you know, you hire for the quant,
exactly.
You
know? Yeah.
I would say we haven't done any paid advertising to this date, which, you know, not everyone has not everyone has that luxury from, I guess, just like an organic traction right. perspective. And
this because you got really good PR very early on and very, you know, I think the brand speaks to that and like the product definitely, you had like foodie people.
Yeah.
Really into it from the beginning. And that's a strong crew.
It is a strong crew. So I mean, just from the beginning, targeting the journalists that were writing about this space, targeting the influencers that, you know, I thought would be interested in this product. And then
I don't have an Instagram, but if I did, I would influence for you.
Oh, please make one and then you'll get all the free fish.
My team would be like, wait, you just made an Instagram so that you could talk about Fishwife? Like, that's weird. Yeah.
Honestly, justified. No, if you serve it at your dinner parties, that's influencing as well. So
yes.
You're good. But yeah, I mean, I think just like I knew what our target, you know, incepting customer base was going to be. And, you know, right. a lot of those people are my friends. They're like super, they're cool girls that, you know, live in metropolitan areas and like go mm-hmm. out to cool little wine bars. And, you know, it was pretty clear that group was going to respond well to the company. So
yeah,
you know, just, and, you know, thankfully those people are, they talk a lot. They are mm-hmm. very vocal advocates and, you know, we were just really lucky to have those people on our side from the beginning.
And a question about that. Like, I'm curious because are they talking about the sustainability aspect of it? Or have you found that that is just a nice attribute to have over here on the right, but it is not the main thing that people are talking about? Just a question.
It's a great question. I mean, I think the thing that I have found in running this business and being in the seafood industry is that I would say just the overall general public's sophistication of understanding around seafood sustainability has a very long way to go.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we've been lucky to, you know, be able to educate, not to be preachy, but, you know, to help people start to understand certain aspects of seafood sustainability that maybe they haven't in the past.
Right.
I think, you know, generally aquaculture has gotten a pretty ridiculously bad rap, like people just painting with way too broad a brush about, you know, farm raising seafood.
Right. I mean, for us, it's kind of like, you know, is it recyclable? Like, that is not the actual right question.
Yes, yes.
Right, about when you're talking about packaging sustainability. But by the time we explain emissions and water use, they've walked away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, totally. I think part of my question is like, you know, you have all these, you have the brand, you have a really tasty, delicious product, you have something that, you know, is like great from like a pantry building and like a longevity, like there are all these different things that you can talk to, and you have a really, you know, thoughtfully sustainable, you know, product. You know, it's hard to talk about all of those things in the same breath. And so I was just wondering if, you know, the virality of it, were you surprised that people didn't care as much as you thought they would? Or, you know, I don't know, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that people don't know exactly what questions to ask at this point.
Yeah.
To me, it seems really like an incredible opportunity that we will hopefully be able to be a big part of education around like what sustainability really means going forward. I have no problems admitting that, you know, I am not a marine biologist and I did not come from, you know, a major certifying body or it's not the industry that I was from. So I think the tact that I have taken is just surrounding myself with those people. And I think as the company, you know, continues to roll out new products that, you know, each of which have really, really interesting stories behind them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll be using those products as educational platforms to talk about, you know, different areas of seafood sustainability. So like for our salmon, you know, people do not know that one of the main questions to ask around salmon farming is, you know, what are the components of the feed ingredients?
Right.
I mean, it's just people just, how can you expect them to know that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, working with a company like Quarry Arctic is the company that we work with for our salmon. You know, they're doing really, really incredible work in the responsible aquaculture space from all angles. But, you know, I like to zoom in on the feed that they're using, which is a mixture of, you know, is fermented microalgae, which is, you know, the source of the really, really high omega-3 content in our salmon.
Yeah.
And then for the marine, I see like I'm already getting into a place where I'm probably losing some people.
No, but I mean, I think it's interesting because it does lead to sort of the innovation question, right? Like I know with us, you know, we're evaluating obviously what the co-packer can handle. It can't be too sticky because we don't get enough through the pipes.
Yep.
We would like to use ingredients that aren't like very hard to get because of things like supply chain, you know, deficiencies or discrepancies or difficulties. And then there's also just sort of like the color that would look pretty on the shelf next to our other colors of sauce. So, you know, does that play a role in your innovation, you know, planning, you know, the story behind the fishery or the story behind the particular fish?
Yeah, no, I think it totally does. Like, I mean, I think about, you know, with the three hero products we have right now, they all have really interesting sustainability stories. So like, and, you know, reveal a new layer of, you know, what does seafood sustainability mean? So like with our tuna, it means obviously we're catching hook and line in a well-managed fishery, which is the North Pacific. So, you know, a well-managed fishery, what does that mean? It means that there's really good data on the health of the population of that species that we're looking at. And, you know, we're using a catch method that is, you know, viewed to be the most sustainable catch method. So that's a very different story than our salmon. And again, it's really exciting because we get to use these products that have entirely different origin stories that taste incredible as platforms off which we can, you know, help people begin to wrap their heads around the insane complexities of seafood sustainability.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's all very, very cool. We have a couple more minutes, but I want to go back to something you said too, because, you know, you definitely started online. You started with this like hardcore group of like people who like tin fish. And then, I mean, you are in retail stores.
Yeah.
But, you know, it felt to me when I was looking through the store locator, it felt like that cool cheese shop on your corner or like that, you know, the shop that sells like all those fun, cool sort of, you know, artisan products from different places, like pretty branding, you know, cool kind of not gifty necessarily, but a little bit more specialty, not necessarily like mass grocery. Was that a plan? Like, was that part of that distribution strategy or were you sort of like, wow, there are all these places that like actually carry tin fish. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yep, it is all part of the master plan. I mean, I think there is something really special about, you know, like building up your company and your reputation and your community incrementally. So like, I think for us that meant, and a little bit of a scarcity thing. It's like, no, you cannot find our products at Whole Foods and Sprouts mm-hmm. yet.
Right.
That is, you know, that is the long-term vision. But I think I mentioned this to you in my note, the idea of making a household brand.
Yeah.
Which is something I was actually...
a lot longer than people think.
It takes a lot. I was talking to Ian from Three Wishes about this, and it really, what he said really resonated with me, which is just you cannot flip a switch and have a household brand. Like you think about all these brands that we love, like Ben and Jerry's and Stacy's and all, you know, they took years and years and years to establish their foothold in our homes.
Well, I think that's part of, you know, I think I quote Miguel probably every episode, but, you know, he always sort of goes back to like it, having a brand that is bigger than what the business is, is a great place to be because it means that, you know, you are creating momentum. It's also the more expensive place to be. It means that your gross margin needs to be stronger. It means that you're probably going to have to raise more money because you're going to have to build the business to fit into the brand, right? It means your sales are probably not caught up to, people always think you punch above your weight kind of situation. And it is the better of the two problems to have. And the other side is, you know, you have a big business and you don't have a brand really to speak of. You're very quickly going to become a commodity or, you know, like you said, there isn't that sort of like soul behind it. You know, that said, those of us who are sort of like, we feel like we're building these brands and, you know, we are getting traction and, you know, it starts to feel like, oh my gosh, I totally, blah, blah, blah. Like I see that everywhere. Like you guys are everywhere. You know, that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
We have a very long, long way to go. And I think that when you try to buy it, whether that's just like a massive investment into Instagram ads or it's a massive investment into glowing, you know, going global with Whole Foods day one.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard. Because you haven't figured stuff out yet. It can happen. People have done it, especially second and third time founders. But, you know, part of the reason I think Ian's right about, you know, why it takes that long is because you come out of the gate with something, but you don't know yet why people love it.
Yeah.
Who are the people that love it and why and how are they using it? And, you know, what's making them stick with you? And until you start really understanding that, you can't really market correctly. You're just kind of throwing things into the awareness bucket, you know? And I mean, we're still, you know, this is our fourth year now on the shelf. I mean, our second year national, but, you know, we're still every day struggling with, you know, what do we want to put on the front of our pouch? Mm-hmm. What's the most important thing to people? What do we want to lead with in, you know, in our messaging? I don't know that we're anywhere close to figuring that out. I keep thinking we are, and then it keeps like slipping through my fingers. And my guess is that that's a 10-year curve. And that's why you need money, because you're likely not going to be profitable for the first part of that if you are doing experiments and trying to figure it out, unless you happen to have like phenomenal gross margins, you know, which can happen. But
which can happen sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Which can happen, which is cool. Okay. Before we head off, you know, one thing you wish someone would have taught you or told you, what's, you know, you were sort of in touch with a lot of founders and mentors, you know, what do you keep hearing over and over again that you just keep reminding yourself or you think is sort of like the, you know, most important or the negative, like what's something, you know, not to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think a big part of it is, yes, I would say the like value of your, this is not new, but your founder network cannot be measured and they will, those are, I think it's the strongest asset of this business, because I feel I have, you know, many of the best folks in the game, helping, you know, helping navigate the way. So I think, you know, I definitely ask for advice a lot, mm-hmm. probably more than the average person. And I think just knowing, I do think that is, in my experience, it has been an incredibly positive way to start a business. But at some point, understanding that you're taking all that information and distilling it and finding what is your personal philosophy. And
right.
you really do have to trust that, because at the end of the day, it sucks. It really does. But there's no one that, you know, is living your life and in your shoes and, you know, has the desires that you have for what your life and business look like. So
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And I think also, you know, we hear so much, like, people are like, tell us about social nature. And I'm like, first tell me about your goals and tell me about your product. Like, it's so product and category and distribution network specific. It's so, like, all of these things. There are some, you know, principles, like almost like physics of businesses. Like, you should try to have XYZ margin and you should not do XYZ, like make an unsafe product. Like, there are some like fundamentals, but there's a lot that's just sort of, again, the cap to the bottle and the founder and the market fit and all of those things, you know, and the category for sure. All right, Becca, was it everything you hoped it would be?
Oh my gosh, everything and more. I can't wait to listen. Well, actually, I don't know if I will listen to my
own. I know, it's very hard to listen. I have a hard time listening. And going back to the ones that I did in like June of 2018, when I was like, what is business? Like, what is a product? Like,
yes.
I kind of like cringe, but you know,
so it's
amazing. All right. Any one you want to shout out was like your favorite episode, like since you are such a listener.
Yeah, I will say I listened to Noah's from Ruby.
Uh-huh.
And it just like, I was like, oh man, this is my type of founder. I like hunted him down and I think we have a call this week. I mean, it seems like everyone loves this guy. So good for you, Noah.
No, that's so funny. That's adorable. Yeah. No, he is all of that. He's adorable. I just saw him last week. All right. Anyway, Becca, thank you so much for coming on. Everyone go to eatfishwife.com. I know I have a plan for a dinner party with like lots of tin fish coming up. That's just in my head now. Armin, as always, thank you for engineering. And I'm sorry that I went a little over on this one. And listeners, thank you. You guys really liked the last couple of weeks. That's awesome. I'm thrilled. Thank you for listening. I hope it's helpful. Always feel free to DM me with like recommendations for other guests or, you know, questions that you wish I had asked. I really do, you know, I read everything in LinkedIn, so I don't have an Instagram, but I do read everything on LinkedIn. So I will be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.